I'm Mark Gagan, and you're listening to the Voice of Insurance podcast, produced in association with AdvantageGo. Release your underwriters to underwrite with AdvantageGo's underwriting platform. Most of my interviewees are good at using insurance to solve problems, but today's guests, Natalia Dorfman and James Kench of Lloyd's Lab alumnus Keita, are taking this to a whole new level. This is because the problem Keita wants to help solve is what most would say is the biggest of our generation: climate change. Keita's still going to do this by solving client problems and making underwriting profits, but it's inventing a whole new class of insurance to do so. Carbon credits are key to the world hitting its 2050 net zero targets, but as a major and highly valuable asset, they need high quality insurance to be able to scale up at the speed that is needed if a meaningful, positive climate impact is to be made. If we think of a carbon credit in its simplest terms as a physical asset like a forest that's been planted to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, the amount of things that could go wrong is enormous. The trees could burn down or blow over or die from drought, pests or disease. The grower might go bust or just run off with your money and not plant anything. Your carbon credit could be nationalised by a foreign government, or it could be wiped out by the change in the methodologies of those who calculate these things, or it could just turn out that the trees you planted might not sequester as much carbon as expected. There's a lot of moving parts, and my example is the simplest of many increasingly complex and technical solutions. If we're going to make a big dent in climate change, we're going to need to scale a currently tiny industry many hundred times so that it grows as big as the oil and gas sector is today. That's where the multiplying effect of insurance comes in. If a project is insured, a fund might be able to buy into three projects instead of one, and a bank will be able to lend much more using the same amount of capital. By finding out what could go wrong the hard way, insurance also helps spread best practice and adds another layer of due diligence. Whichever way you look at it, what Natalia and James are building is one of the most exciting new classes of insurance to emerge since cyber. And it's the good kind. Insurance with a strong moral purpose, so any profits can come guilt-free. Natalia and James are really impressive, and I think you'll find this podcast informative and inspiring. Half an hour with these two, and you'll have a spring in your step, and you'll be recommending a career in insurance to every young person that you meet. Enjoy the podcast. Natalia and James, welcome to the Voice of Insurance.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much. Great to be here.
Why don't you just make a quick introductions of yourselves and your careers to date and sort of how you've ended up where you are?
Yeah, of course. I'm happy to start. So I'm Natalia Dorfman. I'm the CEO and one of the co-founders of Keita. In terms of my career to date, I started in environmental science at university. That's what I studied, impact of climate change on tree growth, tropical field biology, kinds of things that are very relevant now to what we do at Keita, but which, to be honest, I didn't spend any of my career doing. After studying that at university, I fell into the career of doing business development and strategy at international law firms. I did that in New York, Brussels, and London, and that led me to Clyde & Co., which I am assuming probably many of your listeners know.
Probably the law firm that's most synonymous with insurance.
Yes, exactly. And so I was there for 8.5 years, and that's where I learned sophisticated insurance, Lloyd's specialty insurance, and where I became a huge advocate of how important insurance is to the functioning of the global economy. And over time at Clyde & Co., I became global head of new business. And in that role, I led the strategy for the firm's climate risk practice. And so that was the combination of forces that led me to Keita. It was working with Clyde & Co's excellent partners on the regulations and liabilities that were driving insurers and other companies to change on climate change, looking at the negative impacts upon their business, as well as how they could create opportunities. And sometimes that involved the carbon markets. And I suppose over time doing that, I decided that all I wanted to do for the rest of my career was focus on climate change. And so I decided to leave Clyde & Co. to do that, and that eventually led to Keita. I can go into more detail on that.
No, we will definitely go into more detail on Keita. So James, tell us about yourself.
Yeah, sure. I'm James Kench. I'm head of insurance at Keita. So I'm looking at distribution, product development, kind of capacity side of things. My background, I was originally a biology chemistry undergrad. So that was my sort of passion was, you know, all things ecology and climate. I then sold my soul to the corporate world into law, not at Clyde & Co., but I did intern at Clyde & Co., but I started with Mayor Brown in the city here. And that was my first exposure to insurance, actually. I had a in-house secondment to Marsh, and I enjoyed the law, but I found what the clients were doing was more interesting, particularly the insurance brokers. So then I moved to a firm called Jardine Matheson in Asia, the sort of holding company of JLT. Ended up in JLT, had a ton of fun with JLT and then Marsh, but always in emerging markets, emerging risks, product development, and just kind of building new stuff. So.
And then how did you meet up with Natalia?
Just through a sort of a headhunter, actually. We got connected with Natalia and the team. We just kind of clicked.
So, Natalia, you're the founder. And then he's one of the early recruits.
Yes, exactly. I mean, honestly, I feel like starting a company is a bit like dog years. So it feels like James has been with us for years, but it's actually only been almost exactly your 1 year anniversary. And yeah, we were looking for a head of insurance, but we honestly, at the time we met James, we weren't quite ready to hire yet, but his CV came through and it was just such a perfect CV that we thought, well, let's speak to him. And then I remember having the conversation where we thought, well, we don't want to lose him because he's such a good fit. So let's just accelerate that role and see if we can make it work. And so that's what we did. And then here we are.
Quite right. I mean, the people side of things is so important. You forget, especially if you know that you're going to need that role in, I don't know, in months' time, you might as well just crack on once you've met that person. You don't want to lose them, do you? So what's the big idea for Keeta?
The big idea for Keeta is quite simple. It's how do you insure carbon credits? Carbon credits being an intangible asset, but more importantly, carbon credits being representative of tons of carbon dioxide that are either removed from the atmosphere or that avoid going into the atmosphere, which is a key part of fighting climate change.
And for anyone who doesn't know what a carbon credit is, it's an asset you can buy to offset carbon that you're emitting somewhere else.
Yes, exactly. But I would say we can come into this, I suppose, when we talk about the insurance. It's not just to offset tons of carbon you're emitting elsewhere, although that is its primary purpose. But at the end of the day, it epitomizes a ton of carbon dioxide or equivalent gas like methane coming out of the atmosphere. And what we saw with Keeta and the reason we set up, so it's A, honestly, high level, we saw that a lot of the new technologies being set up to fight climate change, it could be hydrogen or batteries or what have you, they don't have specialized insurance that protect their risks and the risks of their investors. And that, in my perspective from working at Clyde & Co, was a key thing that was going to block the scaling of many of these new climate technologies. And then in the carbon space, this is very true in that there certainly was no insurance widely available at scale. And you need trillions of dollars to go into this market to scale up these solutions in order to capture the billions of tons of carbon dioxide we need to. And many of these assets tend to be in developing countries. And so you have this risk upon risk, but which we felt insurance was very well placed to mitigate and where there was a clear gap in the market. And so that's the opportunity we saw with Keeta. But it was really started from an impact perspective of how can we use insurance as an enabler to allow finance to go into this market, to help this market look and feel like something that is investable from an institutional finance perspective.
Because it's a bit of a jungle, isn't it? There are many different bodies that are offering carbon credits and whether those are validated. And so is bringing insurance in, is that way of maturing that market, of validating something, of saying, well, don't take my word for it, that this has got Lloyd's of London insurance behind it. So someone's checked it out. And so I can buy this with confidence, or I can finance this operation with confidence on the sell side as well, isn't it? So what's the main product? I mean, who buys it? I mean, you're selling it, but who's buying it on which side of this equation?
Sorry to interrupt in mid-flow, but this is just a reminder that you could be advertising right here, right now, and getting your message directly into the ear of key decision makers in the insurance industry. And you'll be doing it while they're absolutely in listening mode. The podcast is the medium of the future, and so is audio advertising. Contact me on mark@thevoiceofinsurance.com, and I'll do everything I can to get you started.
Kind of on both sides. So the way we look at it, there's the buy side, the sell side, and the intermediaries.
And who's a typical buyer?
Buyer, sort of two profiles there. There's either corporates that are buying for their own account, and that would be as part of their net zero strategy and sort of using
it. So somebody who's got to do their kind of sustainability report, public company, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
They think, well, let's say that, you know, we know that our employees fly all the way around the world half the time and we use lots of electricity in our offices or whatever it is. And they're going to buy these carbon credits to be able to offset any bad things they're doing.
Yeah. So that's one category. The other is the investors. So folks that see carbon as the next commodity, another market that they want to be exposed to, either for their own account or for building funds for their clients as well.
And they're seeing that as an asset, i.e. the carbon removal, I don't know, investing in a forest or some fantastic new technology that reduces carbon.
I think they see it like a true commodity. Like they look at it as, you know, this is oil, coal, what have you. So they want to get exposure to that. I think the interesting thing for insurance is that while the investors want to see it as a commodity, it looks and feels a lot more like a security. So at a risk level, it's very, very bespoke. And that means, you know, it's a good fit for particularly Lloyd's approach, where you really need to have a deep understanding of this risk. You can't just look at it on a spreadsheet and take
and
a
view. What are the main risks? What are you putting together? Because it sounds like it's a bit of a blend of everything, isn't it?
That is what we've aimed to do, is create a relatively all risks insurance product. But you can break it down into a lot of different sub-risks. And suppose let me first break it down into the project risks, and then we can break it down into the risks that the buyers or investors or developers of carbon credits might consider. But on a project risk basis, you have the risks to the physical asset.
Yeah, and let's sort of imagine what physical asset is. Say it's a forest.
Exactly. So let's say it's a forest, and it also could be more of an infrastructure-heavy asset, but let's pretend it's a forest.
Keep it simple. It's something easy to imagine. Everyone knows what a forest looks like.
Okay, so let's pretend it's a forest and we're planting new trees.
Yeah.
And so somebody's going to be financing the planting of these new trees, and the output of the planting of those trees is carbon credits.
Brilliant.
So the physical asset, the trees, this is very much akin to other insurance products. They could burn down, they could blow down, they could get eaten, and they could get sick, broadly speaking, right?
Yeah.
Physical risk to the trees. You also have the counterparty risks. So the people planting the trees and managing the project, they could be fraudulent, negligent, they could go insolvent, or they could abandon the project. They think this one's not going very well, let's dump it, let's go focus on something else.
Yep.
You have the political risks and regulatory risks of these trees are probably in a country that is not your own from the investor's perspective. Most likely it's in the global south. And due to some changing regulations around the carbon markets and how countries consider carbon assets. So the carbon credits could be nationalized. The export of those carbon credits could be blocked, and other forms of, in essence, political and regulatory risk could befall your carbon credits, meaning that you're no longer able to access them. And then the final point of risk category we look at from the physical side of it, but this links into very much the carbon credit side, would be the methodologies and the science. So I can't just go plant some trees in my garden and sell you some carbon credits. Like, that's clearly not a valid means of calculating it. So if I am to do a carbon project, I need to get that project validated by a carbon standard under one of its methodologies. And there is a risk that the carbon standard itself could be invalidated or go insolvent, leaving you
or
with
you
a stranded asset.
This type of pine tree doesn't extract as much carbon as we thought it did.
Exactly. There's a science risk. And particularly with some of the newer forms of carbon removal technology, there's still a science risk. And so if I were to group them, you have execution risk, which links into the physical and the counterparty, and then you have the science risk. And the way that we consider it is the risk of the physical asset and the risk of the carbon credit. We like to ensure the resulting carbon credit, which should have already been calculated, taking into account that some physical risk should happen. We all expect some fires to happen to those trees, and the resulting carbon credits projected should take that into account. So we feel ensuring the resulting carbon credit is a safer bet than ensuring the underlying physical asset.
And also, is there one other risk? Obviously, carbon credits, like any market, if they're a commodity, they go up and down, there'd be cycles, that you've got the risk of carbon credits sort of collapsing at some point. And I suppose as an insurer, you could be taking that risk, couldn't you? You could be taking in dollars on one end and then paying out in carbon credits at the other end, and they might end up being more expensive than the dollars were.
It's a key concern, I think, in the market at the moment. The way we get around that now at the moment is we use like an agreed value policy. So it's X number of credits at Y dollars or pounds per credit equals your sum insured.
So everyone's happy.
But with the ability, because we do multi-year policies, the ability to increase or review that limit over time, depending on where the market is.
That was one of my other questions, actually. My intuition was that this is probably likely to be multi-year, isn't it? Because forest is not a 12-month enterprise. It's a 20, 30-year thing, isn't it? So are you sort of doing policies for the duration of a project?
Yeah. Our approach is we try to match the what we call the non-delivery risk to the investment timeline of that project, which for forestry can be 30 years. We can go out to 10 years, and that's sort of a maximum we can get comfortable with. But we do see opportunity for annual policies as well. But the big chunk of the risk at the moment is just getting the projects started, executing, and you know, that's where the big challenge is for the market, and insurance can help de-risk that. Once there's a bit more critical mass in the market, then there'll be, I think, room for annual policies around the potential invalidation, reversal of these credits over time, things like that.
I do think actually just on this, because this is one of the challenges in the market from the carbon perspective, carbon projects are usually planned out for around 100 years. And people often expect to get their returns over around 30 to 40 years. And so people, particularly when we first launched, came to us looking for a 40-year insurance policy. And that is not possible. However, I do think increasingly the carbon markets themselves are getting more sophisticated in terms of the financing structures they're looking at. And so increasingly there's opportunities for shorter insurance policies. For example, on a portfolio basis, the portfolio might change annually. So it might be most cost effective from the client's perspective to look at an annual basis portfolio policy. Or if somebody's looking at it from an investment perspective and they're investing in CapEx, they'll usually have a shorter period of return. So you might be more feasible with a 4 or 5 year policy. So it's a changing space that we are trying to educate where you do not need a 40-year insurance policy, and nor would that make any sense from a cost perspective.
So you could almost do like a stop-loss type thing for someone who's got a lot of carbon credits and a nice diversified portfolio. Mm-hmm. They're going to be a pretty good risk. It's almost like giving them a treaty type policy.
Well, that's one of the products we're building now, actually, around that kind of view, either for clients that hold portfolios of risk or some of the intermediaries that do that to kind of enable the rest of the transactions and the plumbing to push ahead.
What's your kind of go-to product? 100 years ago, whenever Cuthbert Heath invented most policies, and certainly sitting in this room, we're sitting in the Lloyd's Lab, by the way, which is obviously, Lloyd's Lab is where I first came across Keita. It was about 18 months ago when I came to the pitch day, and you were the stars of the show, I think, that day. And then you've been through the Lloyd's Lab cohort. And are you still using this office?
Yes, here? We are still using this office. The lab is very, very supportive to its cohort companies. You can't be here while the new cohort is busy, but they let you stay otherwise.
And stay until they kick you out.
Exactly.
Banker's blanket bond, you know, it's the product and it's still being sold today, I'm sure. What's the name of your product? What do you call it? Have you found a sort of killer application of what you're trying to do? Have you found it yet at something that, oh, this really resonates with people. This is at least the core product that they need. And when I go out there, the client goes, yes, I want one of those.
Yeah, our main product we call Carbon Purchase Protection Cover. So basically covering non-delivery. You prepay now for X tons of carbon at Y pounds a ton for delivery at date Z up to 1, 3, 5, 10 years. If they don't get it for any reason, then the insurance kicks in. And then we can either pay out in cash or we can pay out in like-for-like carbon credits. It's an all-risk policy. The only exclusion for now is that political risk that Natalia mentioned earlier. So we're building a new product to fill that gap.
Yeah, because you're in the right place to deal with political risk. So I would have thought that's something you can add in.
In terms of where insurance capacity will get interested in the carbon markets, I think political risk is perfect. The reason we didn't start there, though, is because there are a lot of changes going on right now within the regulatory environment of carbon markets. So, for example, something around Article 6, where countries are considering how they consider the carbon assets within their own countries to meet what they would term their own nationally determined contributions, which are basically their net zero strategies. A lot of countries' consideration of this is very much in flux. And thus, it is a very technical understanding of how countries consider the carbon markets to be able to ensure that political risk. And so even a year ago, we didn't feel comfortable. We felt it was too much like flipping a coin. Now we're getting to the point where we think we can make educated underwriting assessments. And thus, we're looking to launch a product.
And Article 6, what's that?
Article 6 of the Paris Agreement.
Ah.
Well, we can get very technical on this if you wish.
No, good. Yeah, well, yes, no, my job, I suppose, is if you ever do get technicals, you need to then explain to me what it is, and particularly if you use a three-letter abbreviation.
There you go.
So I'm sure you call that your product CPP, don't you?
CPPC, yeah.
CPPC, sorry.
There you go.
I'm sure once you put it in the hands of a broker. So CPPC, CPPC, please. How many of you are there now? How many staff have you got?
So we have 10 full-time. We have 3 part-time. And then 2 advisors. So total around 15, but with that 10 full time. And that very much is our focus, is staying as lean as we can. And I think we are fortunate in that it is technical underwriting expertise, and we don't need to scale out a team of 100 data scientists. We can keep relatively lean for the time being.
Yeah. And what are those people mostly doing?
The team is split into, I say loosely, carbon, insurance, data. The carbon team are specialists in the carbon markets and are very much out there engaging in the market and understanding the risks, the evolving financing structures, and the regulations, because the carbon markets are always changing. Insurance, of course, is James' core area, but that's our very technical underwriting. That's our R&D in terms of new products. That's our work with capacity. That's our regulatory environment. And then on the data science point, of course, we do have data scientists that we're looking at building out our in-house risk engine and creating the efficiencies that enable us to underwrite with speed. All of this, of course, has the overlay of regulation and compliance, as anyone does have.
Yeah, because I imagine because it's so multifaceted, it could be quite slow to getting a quote. Once one of the brokers comes in and says, right, I've got XYZ, big corporate wants something. Can you get out quickly to them?
At the moment, for that non-delivery product, we're insuring a transaction. So therefore, we're kind of tied to the transaction life itself. As soon as we have all the complete information, like classic underwriter caveat, but probably about 2 weeks that we need to turn around a very detailed underwrite. But we can give an early steer, non-binding, within a few days or so. I think over time, it's going to get a lot more automated as the market matures, we get more intel and data on the loss trends. But for now, it's quite a classic underwriting bespoke model for us.
And at the moment, you're Lloyd's cover holder, so this is Lloyd's Security. What sort of limit can you offer?
At the moment, per transaction, we can do £5 million. We're just working with our partners to up that. That was year one proof of concept. But we're finding as more of the institutional investors come into the space, the deal sizes are sort of 5, 10x that. So we're playing in some deals there with our £5 million still relevant. But I think the good thing about Lloyd's is you can syndicate and there's a great deal of markets that want to be active in the space. And we can partner with them to say, these are the risks. This is how we view it. And if you want to take a slice on this line, then...
And presumably your way into market, this has to be brokered.
Yes. Yeah. I think the future for this market is definitely a brokered model. We see it a lot like how D&O and then cyber evolved the last sort of couple of decades. I think the challenge in the short term, like Natalia was saying, it's that sort of awareness issue. So both on the client side, but also in the market. So we do a ton of work just raising awareness with the brokers, with the markets and teaching clients around insurance. And then we can kind of wrap that up in a bow and present it to the brokers to place.
Well, hopefully, yeah. Well, and you come on podcasts, which is all part of the job. Hopefully people listening out there who didn't quite know what this was all about, now that we're getting more into the nitty gritty of it, will understand. And then obviously we'll have all your contacts at the bottom in our notes. Obviously, within this Lloyd's environment, there are syndicates in boxes. There are lots of new mechanisms by which you could start to build your own balance sheet. Is that an ambition?
Yeah, for sure. Went the MGA route to start with, and I think it's kind of the perfect model.
Way to prove the concept, isn't it?
Exactly. But we'd love to build out the balance sheet in sort of two dimensions. One on the insurance side to kind of build a fund or at least, you know, have some skin in the game. I think that's always resonates well with capacity providers. And then also on the carbon side. So exploring midterm, could we build our own carbon reserve? So therefore, when there is a claim, we can pay out in like for like carbon credits at the moment using like a supplier panel. But it'd be good to do that with our own funds as well. And then we could start to maybe hedge some of that market price risk that you mentioned at the start.
Yes, 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 yes. Far better to have your own currency.
Interestingly, we have a strategy away day this week. And to prepare for that, I was looking back at some of our earliest pitch decks. And it's interesting that our strategy on this have never changed. From our very first pitch deck, we always said, A, we want to be as fast to market as possible. So we started out as an appointed rep, then MGA, and then I see it as climbing the regulatory ladder. So we always wanted to own our own capital, and we always wanted some of that capital to be in carbon credits. And we think that that will enable us both the impact that we can have in the carbon markets, but also the ability to still be fast and agile while we build up to that. And that's always been what we want to do. And this year is actually quite exciting because we think we can start executing some of it.
What about expanding internationally? You're here and you haven't got offices anywhere else yet. And would you plan on doing so?
Well, this also actually going back to that first pitch deck, we always also said we want to be as international as possible because the carbon markets are very, very international. So one of the key benefits of being a Lloyd's cover holder is the ability to use that licensing to enter new jurisdictions. So we started out with the US and UK. We now have Canada, Singapore, and Switzerland. And we hope to be able to announce the EU shortly. But yes, international expansion will always be very much one of our areas of focus.
The other thing is we can expand out by the Lloyd's Direct model, looking at sort of reinsurance risk code, and then we can access some of the markets via sort of local front, for example, Brazil, etc. We do have two folks in the US, actually myself and one other on the carbon side, and we're just setting up a US entity there at the moment just to kind of get us a little bit closer to the action. The US is going to be just a massive market in this space, so it's good to be on the ground and sort of plugged in there.
So it sounds like you still need more investment to do this, or you're fully funded now?
We are funded. So we did a seed round in December 2022, and we have a pretty low cost base. So we are pretty well funded. But yes, at some point, we will certainly be needing more investment and in particular to build out that capacity side. Definitely, that'll be something we'll be looking at latter half of this year.
Are you kind of aggressive in that sense that it's kind of build it and then they'll come? Or you, let's make sure that people are nibbling on what we've got at the moment before we start to take a big risk.
It's a combination of the two. I think I am of the view, and we always have been, myself and my two co-founders, that one of the reasons we wanted to start an insurance company in this space is because we thought somebody needed to go out there and take the risk and prove it could be done. Climate change is happening and it's happening quickly, and we only have so long to find solutions. So you need to have a go. You need to just go big. Now that we have a company and we're up and running, we need to prove more of the market before we're able to, of course, get investment in behind it because we're at that stage. But still, I think it's in our core DNA to want to be a first mover and want to prove how it's done. So it's a balancing act between the two, but really one of our key values is how can we do this quickly?
The proof of the pudding is always claims, isn't it? In insurance, we're selling claims in the end. What's the typical claim you're expecting when it does come?
Well, I mean, I do honestly think we will have claims. Just we haven't had any. I'm not aware of any claims within the carbon insurance space yet.
Obviously, because there are forest fires anyway. We know that they're happening every year with greater frequency.
I would expect our most likely claim, to be honest, not to be due to a natural catastrophe, because a lot of natural catastrophes are already modeled into the carbon outputs. So a well-run carbon project, which we think we are good at due diligencing, will already expect to have a good number of natural catastrophes. And they will have modeled that into their carbon forecast.
So that project itself would be big enough and well-diversified enough not to put all its eggs in one basket.
Exactly. I think we would be most likely to see significant claims due to counterparty risk, the fraud, negligence, insolvency type risks. And we might see claims on the carbon standard invalidation point, but I think we have mitigated our risk there in terms of how we underwrite. I think our key risk can be in that counterparty risk. And as we move into the political risk side, I think we will certainly see some claims there. But I think the claims process will be to some extent a relatively traditional one, and we need to see evidence of a loss and we have a waiting period. I think the nuance will come in when we pay insurance claims and replacement carbon credits, because the challenge here is not paying a claim, it's finding a like-for-like carbon credit replacement.
An indemnity, yeah.
People are very specific about what carbon they buy, and they are not fungible asset classes. And I think that equivalency ratio, fungibility asset class is the challenge for the insurance industry to find the liquidity there. And that's something that we think a lot about.
Do you think there's likely to be a centralization of some of the carbon assets that we might end up with one, in like a big Bitcoin of carbon assets?
I don't think there'll be one type of credit. I think there'll be sort of subclasses. So you might get a South American reforestation class A kind of credit, and then a engineered carbon, you know, in the US kind of credit. I can see that happening. Some of the finance folks who we mentioned earlier, they're trying to kind of engineer those types of structures. So they're kind of thinking ahead 3-5 years down the line of bundling up these stuff into securitized packets so they can then trade. So I think they might come that way, but I think in the short term, it's very much very risk specific.
Long term, if we do hit net zero, which is a really big if, does that mean you put yourselves out of business?
You know, that's a really, really good question. The short answer is no.
Because it's net zero, isn't it?
Exactly. the depressing truth is, I would say it gets quite depressing. The odds of us meeting anything close to a net zero or hitting any kind of, again, going back to the Paris Agreement, 1.5 degree aligned temperature target is getting slimmer and slimmer. But even if we did and we get to 2050, it is net zero. So that still means we are emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and we need to remove the equivalent amount from the atmosphere to hit that net. The removal is only carbon removal credits. And so when you look at what we need to do, and I think this is why a lot of the forecasts go out to 2050, is because the removals right now are about 0.5 of a million tons, and they need to get up to 5 to 15 billion tons per year, which is, if you think about the oil and gas industry, I think about 5 billion tons of oil are piped around. So you need an industry that's basically nothing to go up to the size of the oil and gas industry by 2050. And then just like the oil and gas industry, you need it to be a self-sustaining industry that continues to remove 5 to 15 billion tons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere every year after 2050. Because even if we can meet the net in net zero, we still actually have to remove the residual carbon dioxide that is in the atmosphere from today and in previous decades' actions. I know a lot of the forecasts go out to 2050 as if then we're done. I think that is more just the implausibility of modeling out too far beyond that. But the point is to build an industry that then exists post 2050 at scale. Right now, we're really at the getting to scale stage. If we can get there, then I think you are a sizable industry with sizable insurance needs. Right now, it's really getting there. And that's where the huge amount of investment is required.
Yes. And I suppose when you're pitching, you need to sort of have an eye-catching number to say, well, how big could this industry be? You know, we think, could this be the next cyber, for example, trying to get people's attention and say, well, is this the thing you should go into now? If you're a young graduate or a young school leaver joining the insurance industry, should you be clamoring to get on the carbon team somewhere? Because what's the potential? And what do you think? I mean, I know you've got a report, which I'll put the link into, actually. It's a very interesting report, but I'd rather hear you say it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we did a great report with Oxbo just a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, we think the potential is big, mainly because of that climate maths that's stacking up against us in the background. So to get that scale up is going to need massive investment. And then that investment brings risks and that's going to need insurance. Our kind of forecasts are by the end of the decade, we think it could be up to $1 billion of premium per year. I think, and then by 2050, that's the real scale up. It could be about $10 to $30 billion per year. And that's just kind of following off from some of the numbers that the big banks and consultants are thinking at the sort of high end level of where these markets are going to be. And then trying to kind of convert that into, you know, here's the insurance penetration rate. Here's the insurance rate as a composite for all P&C lines, plus some of the bespoke carbon coverages that are coming up. And we think it's a big opportunity for the whole market.
So saying it's the next cyber is not actually exaggerating too much. No. The next cyber over the next 25 years.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think those numbers are even potentially quite conservative. I do think that it's not going to scale up overnight. There is a ton of education that needs to happen, and the carbon markets themselves are rapidly evolving this decade. But James, correct me if I'm wrong, those forecasts don't take into account the increasing regulation. They are just looking at the projections of the voluntary carbon market as a voluntary market. I think there's a lot of expectation that the voluntary nature of this is going to increasingly become more of a regulated nature. And if insurance were to play into that regulated nature in a way that's a little bit more mandated, then those numbers could go up significantly. I truly think, going back to that new graduate, where do I want to work? A, I think it's a huge opportunity to be at the ground floor and really develop an expertise that will be in high demand. But then I also think it really is a very unique opportunity in doing something that combines profit and purpose, because I think we will build some very profitable lines of business and companies here. But also, if we do this well, then every single project we insure is in essence insuring tons of carbon dioxide that are going out of the atmosphere. And every single claim that we pay notes that some of those tons weren't kept underground successfully, and we can actually track what we think of as gross written carbon, which is a direct, tangible, quantifiable impact that an insurance company in the insurance industry is able to have in fighting climate change, which I think a lot of the big insurers and reinsurers are going to be looking for those types of tangible impacts that they can look on their balance sheets. I do think really a huge opportunity, but obviously we have a lot of bias in our opinion there.
And in terms of products, obviously, this core product is the buyer product. So you want to buy a credit, you want to make sure it's there and you get your credit. And is there anything that could be for the sellers?
Yeah. So from the sellers, they're thinking about some of the warranties that they provide to the buyers.
So they could be guaranteeing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you could be doing the guarantee.
Yeah, exactly. Same for the intermediaries that they're transacting these credits between the buy side and sell side. They may have some implicit or explicit warranties, guarantees,
sort of legal. Just sort of standard D&O for someone who runs a carbon exchange is going to be quite painful and quite, I presume, almost impossible to place right now.
Yeah. D&O as well. So yeah, a ton of risk out there.
PI.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose, yes, just liability.
Yeah.
One last question is, what sort of entrepreneurs are you? There are different types. There's some who love to prove a concept and solve this puzzle. And then actually, you know, once the rocket's sort of flying off, they're not that interested in the day-to-day management of a business, of operational stuff. And then they want to go and have another exciting new idea and then go and do that. Are you those sort of entrepreneurs, or are you more sort of, I want to see this through forever and sort of have my name above the door there? And your name is not above the door. Keita's name is above the door. But do you want to carry it on forever and sort of say, this is the thing I want to leave to my grandchildren?
I mean, that's a good question too. To be honest, I actually don't really think of myself as an entrepreneur.
I think you are.
I recognize that I fall into this category now by pure definition, but it's not how I would self-identify in that, like you said, the entrepreneur who builds new things and moves on and wants to always sell and create and, you know, exit. I just wanted to work in climate change. And I saw an opportunity to do that in a way that I thought could create an impact via starting my own company. And I was very fortunate to meet Paul and Tom, my co-founders, and then James and the other members of our team. And so I suppose from that basis, I would see myself more as staying with Keeta because I really believe in what we're trying to do. I don't, however, think that I will forever and always be Keeta's best CEO, because I think at some point, if we're able to succeed and we grow to the international scale and we have our own risk balance sheet and our carbon fund, et cetera, there is probably somebody out there who has a better skill set than me to run that type of business. So what role I play in Keeta forever is to be determined. And I would like to think that I have the ability to look out for the best interest of the company, but I don't see myself as kind of the startup flipper and going on to something bigger and better. I believe in what we're trying to do here.
So you want to be hanging around to be the chairman of something?
Yeah, I can be a chief strategy officer. Give me some weird title.
Brilliant. Just to reflect on your experience so far, what's been the biggest problem that you had to solve to get this far?
I'm going to say two big problems. One is education and the other is the speed of the carbon markets. So on that one, the carbon markets, particularly the voluntary carbon market, changes so quickly in terms of who's engaging, how they're engaging, what they're buying, how they're financing. It makes finding your ideal customer persona in startup language. It makes it finding that and sticking with that difficult. But then I think more importantly, it's the education in terms of one, educating the carbon markets as to why they need insurance. So I would say the carbon market sprung out of, to a large extent, sustainability teams looking at this from an impact perspective. And so to some extent, if they lose because it was almost a charitable donation. And some of that mentality is still embedded in of, oh, we don't need insurance. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So changing the mentality and helping them understand how insurance can actually help them to leverage their impact is very important. And then, of course, where James comes in, and Alec, our senior underwriter, educating the insurance industry as to which of their clients would be interested, how their clients engage with carbon, how insurance can be placed, all of this, educating the insurance industry, and very much we need to get more capacity in the market so that we can do the bigger deals. That's my take on it. I don't know if James has a different one.
No, I think you're completely right. And it's that getting from the chief sustainability officer to the CFO and the risk manager, that's the kind of key hurdle at the moment. I think that's where we see working with the brokers, they're, you know, amply qualified to do that.
It was a moment early on in this podcast where I realized I probably better ask you what a carbon credit is, because I thought, really to your point about education, I don't want to need to assume that knowledge in everyone, because not everyone knows this kind of, it's not that simple and needs someone friendly to tell you what it is. And then also you're right about, obviously, all of us understand how insurance works. It allows to multiply the good effects of something by allowing a bank to lend more money or to do two projects instead of one because they're insured, or to do a bigger limit or whatever, which is therefore good and allows more good economic activity to happen. But you're right. I think there's an element of that side of the environmental movement that certainly doesn't understand anything about how capitalism can do good things and mostly assumes it is quite bad.
To be honest, I think all of us get into our own little echo chambers. And just like we might sit here and assume everyone knows what a carbon credit is, you know, within the insurance industry, everyone sits there and assumes, A, that everyone knows why you buy insurance, and then B, that everyone knows what your limit is and all that. And people just don't. And it's been a really learning experience that people have no idea what we're talking about. And we really need to take it to the basics of what insurance can do, why it matters. And that's probably a lesson for the wider insurance industry as well. How do we sell ourselves? Because I truly think it's one of the most important industries out there in many ways, but particularly for climate change.
Well, that's the best thing about insurance, is because if it's not simple enough to explain to anybody, there's something probably wrong with it, I would say. And on that note, thank you so much. I've learned a huge amount, and I hope everyone listening has. And good luck with everything.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, don't forget to subscribe or leave a like or a review or recommendation on whatever podcast platform you used to access this program. These really help get the word out. Before we go, just a quick reminder that advertising slots are available here and in other places in the Voice of Insurance podcasts. Podcasting is the fastest growing medium and attracts a high quality audience of key decision makers. It's also an intimate medium where you, the listener, are right in the room with me and the interview subjects. Needless to say, that means it's a great way of getting your message out directly to an audience because you know you've got their full attention. It's also very cost effective. So get in touch with Mark at thevoiceofinsurance.com to find out how you could be speaking directly to the industry. The Voice of Insurance is produced in association with Advantage Go. Release your underwriters to underwrite with Advantage Go's underwriting platform. Voice of Insurance is produced by me, Mark Gagan. Music was written by Anna Gagan and produced by Carlos Gagan. Check out more podcasts and written comment pieces at www.thevoiceofinsurance.com.